A couple of years ago, an American company called Colossal Biosciences announced it had brought back from extinction a breed of wolf, the dire wolf. And negotiations are continuing now with Native American tribal groups for rewilding this animal. Meanwhile, at Melbourne University, work's underway in the hope of bringing the thylacine, the Tassie tiger, back from extinction. Now, the dire wolves show it can be done. The question is, should we be playing God in this way? And will the prospect, however faint, of bringing species back from extinction make us more careless about saving those heading that way? These are a few of the thorny issues that Professor Sadia Qureshi considers in her new book, Vanished: An Unnatural History of Extinction. Sadia Qureshi, Chair of Modern British History at the University of Manchester, describes herself as a historian of science, race, and empire. She joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, David.
How successful have attempts been to bring species back from extinction? I'm not sure whether you're familiar with the dire wolf situation, but you certainly write about Celia the goat in Spain. How promising is all this work?
So it depends on how you define de-extinction and what you think what constitutes a successful de-extinction as to whether it's been successful and whether it might not be. Conservation scientists are certainly excited by some of the kind of underlying biological techniques. But the publicity and marketing around these kinds of stories is often, a very optimistic take on what is possible at the moment. So Celia the goat was a Pyrenean ibex, and she was the last of her kind. And before she died, scientists took sample tissues from her, and they then used those sample tissues to create a clone, which the embryo of that clone was then placed into surrogate ibis mothers, and from several hundred embryos attempts, only one kid was born. But that little kid only lived for 7 minutes. She never even took a breath. Afterwards, an autopsy showed that she had a lung defect. So there's lots of ways that you can think about Celia's story. For some people, that could be a successful de-extinction because it showed that the possibility of cloning can work to bring back an extinct species. For other people, it's not a successful de-extinction because the kid never lived long enough to actually take a breath and therefore could never play a functional role in the ecosystem. So a lot of people think you have to have that in addition to the being existing. But there is a way also of telling the story to say, actually, she never went extinct because the cloned material survived. A genetic existence continued in these sample tissues. And so she never really completely died out to begin with. And of course, there are people who would also tell the story that way. So it's a very, very complicated way of thinking about what do we mean by alive, dead, and extinct.
And contested at each of those stages.
But yes, absolutely.
There's a huge difference between a bit of DNA material and a living jumping goat jumping around, isn't there?
I think there is, for lots of reasons, partly just because independent of whether a living being is playing a functional role in an ecosystem, I think having respect for life as ways of living means that we should be paying attention to thinking about extinction and existences as living beings. And I think if we assume that some genetic tissue surviving or just, you know, frozen genomes surviving means that a species is still intact and exists, I think that's really troubling because it reduces existences to our genetics. And I think that's a fundamentally worrying way to look at and think about the life that we share the planet with, but also our own. I think that's a kind of genetic determinism and genetic essentialism that reduces us to our genes, which is not only troubling, but has a deeply worrying history, whether it's the rise of eugenics or whether it's attacks on thinking about gender in the present day in our trans siblings, this rush to define us by our genetics, solely by our genetics as is existing, I think is a way of trying to reduce us to molecules when really thinking about life and ways of being alive means that we should be thinking about our relationships in the world and, not just in terms of ecosystems, but to each other.
If that little ibex had lived, there would still be a question, wouldn't there, whether it genuinely was a Pyrenean ibex of a species that expired in about 2000, or whether it was something else.
I think with the ibex, most people would probably recognize it as an ibex because she was a direct clone of her mother. So there was no genetic tampering in the sense of tweaking her genome or anything like that. So she was very much a direct copy. So I think for many people, they would see that as a continuation of the species. But there are people, I think, that would see that as actually a kind of new, a recreated life form nonetheless. Where I think most people would tend to become a bit more kind of concerned or a little bit more cautious would be where you have some kind of genetic engineering to change the genome or underlying kind of biology being used to kind of tailor genomes in particular effects. And that's where the direwolf, I think, is a really interesting example. So when the announcement was made about the extinction of the direwolf, there were claims that, this was the first time in 10,000 years that the howl of the direwolf had been heard and so on. But when you dig down beyond the promotional materials and think about the claims actually being made, what really happened was that the company had taken the genome of a grey wolf and tweaked it to make it look like a direwolf. And, so it was very, very kind of precise gene editing. And that effectively is neither a direwolf nor a grey wolf. It's a new life form that has never existed, but is then marketed as a direwolf because that appeals to us emotionally rather than saying we've created new life, full stop. So, and I think that is where there was a lot more controversy. And immediately, many scientists dismissed this as not only a form of de-extinction, but also as recognition of a direwolf, because they recognized that this was not, they didn't recognize it as a true de-extinction because they didn't see it as the resurrection of that particular species, but a genetically modified being that just looked a little bit like a direwolf.
Sadia, our language recognizes that there's nothing as dead as a dodo. What happened to the dodo? What is being done to try to bring the dodo back from the dead?
The dodo is this extraordinary story. So Mauritius was an island that was known by Arab traders for many, many years, but it was only settled by the Portuguese and Dutch in the 1600s. And because the island had no mammals, the dodo was what's very naive, I guess, about what humans were or what mammals were. And when as humans settled on the island, essentially the Portuguese and Dutch used it as a kind of pit stop on trade voyages. But it wasn't just the human beings that arrived, it was also the mammals they brought with them. So the pigs, the rats, the cats, the dogs, and so on. And so these animals then go into that ecosystem and effectively start predating on the dodos themselves. So humans, for instance, can just walk up to a dodo and take it by hand because it's so unafraid of outsiders, because it's evolved in this kind of isolated island ecosystem, while the dodo probably only had, one or two eggs a year, so very breeding very, very slowly. But then those eggs are eaten by the incoming mammals, and so within very, very quickly within a human lifespan, the dodo is extinct. So, and for a long, long time, that story was told as if it was the kind of first recognition of extinction by humans in the modern world. And that's where the kind of expression of dead as a dodo comes from. And of course, that story is also popularized by the dodo featuring in Alice in Wonderland in the 19th century. That's when it becomes a really popular, iconic bird. So for many, many kind of decades, that do the dodo has been the symbol of humans coming into a landscape, into an ecosystem, and through wanton slaughter, whether knowingly or unknowingly, killing off species and ways of being. But what we now have are attempts to bring back the dodo. So it's one of those species alongside mammoths that people often kind of, when they think of the species that makes them the most sad about extinction, I think along with dinosaurs, the dodo and mammoth is up there. And so there's attempts to bring back the dodo as well. And recently there was a huge claim that that is becoming ever more kind of ever closer in reality, because they're what the biggest trick or biggest sort of difficulty with bringing back birds, especially the dodo, would be creating an artificial egg. It's a whole different layer of complexity to bringing back the direwolf or the mammoth. And so scientists have been trying to create an artificial egg for, many, many years. And finally, very, very recently, there was a claim that they had succeeded in doing so, which raises the possibility of potentially bringing back the dodo. But that, again, it wouldn't be the dodo itself. It would be taking the Nicobar pigeon, which is the closest living relative of the dodo, and editing the genome and then transferring the kind of embryo into an artificial egg, and then allowing that egg to come to term.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Sadia Qureshi about de-extinctioning is the expression, as examined in her new book, Vanished: An Unnatural History of Extinction. Sadia, you've seen more or less what's left of the dodo.
Yes.
Where?
So the dodo, despite its famous kind of iconic status, is remarkable in that there's no single skeleton that's known. It's literally everything, all the skeletons you might have seen are composites of other skeletons, and there's almost no living tissue left except for a mummified head in Oxford in the Museum of Natural History. Nobody knows exactly how it came into the collection, but it was almost certainly a dodo that was exhibited in London and then entered the collections of a gardener, father and son gardeners, whose collections were then sold to Elias Ashmole, whose collections then became the foundation of the Ashmolean Museum, which were then transferred to the Natural History Museum when it opened. And it's just extraordinary because this is a mummified head of which there are lots and lots of images, drawings, and things that you can see from the 19th century. And if you see those images, the bird looks asleep and very much asleep. And you don't get a sense of how brittle and frail it is. But in person, it is so desiccated. It looks. It's these kind of almost like leather because it's mummified, and it just looks incredibly frail, and that's all that's left of the dodo. And there's also a tiny feather which looks almost like a needle. It's so thin and so small, and that's all we have left pretty much. There are like little bits of tissue and stuff, but it's effectively in a box in the Natural History Museum, and it's kept in a cupboard, but the location of which is kept secret. So when I went to see it, I wasn't allowed to see where it was kept. It was brought into a room that was separate, because it's so precious, and I'm pretty confident it will never leave that Natural History Museum because it's so rare and so precious and so delicate. And that's all that remains of the soft tissue.
Sadia, did you come to this subject through your interest in imperial history? Because it seems such an imperial story, the extinction of species.
I did, and I originally began actually thinking about the extinction of people. So in the 19th century, a lot of foreign peoples are brought to Britain, and actually in places like Australia, America, India, in terms of world fairs and things like that, living peoples are brought to these kind of metropolitan cities and put on display. And one of the ways that they're advertised is often as the last of their race. And my first book was about those kinds of exhibitions. And then I started thinking about what does it mean to claim that a race is on the verge of extinction. So I started looking into claims that various colonized peoples all over the world were on the verge of extinction, from Aboriginal Australians to Native Nations in America. And very quickly, I realized that they were a really important part of a much, much bigger story. So we're really used to the idea of extinction happening in the natural world all the time as a process. But that's a very relatively modern idea, which comes about during the French Revolution when a man called Georges Cuvier examines bits of fossilized elephantine-like creatures that we would now recognize as the mammoth with Asian and African elephants. And at that time, African and Asian elephants are said to be the same species. And he suggests that not only are they different species, but they're distinct from the mammoth and that the mammoth is probably extinct. And so slowly, the idea that extinction is something that happens all the time becomes embedded in geological circles. But when people are thinking about extinction early on in the 19th century, they tend to think of it with respect to prehistoric animals and animals only. But very, very soon, by the 1820s and 30s, the story of extinction has gone far beyond the realms of geology to thinking about living colonized peoples. So there are huge claims made in the 19th century that colonized peoples are on the verge of extinction. So while you have a story of extinction that is linked to empire through human beings to begin with, it takes a little while longer to think of endangered with respect to animals. So it's deeply connected to empire because many of these claims about extinction are made claiming that various colonized peoples are effectively dying out in the face of superior races. There's a heavily racialized way of thinking about this. And especially from the 1870s onwards, it's often thought of as a form of human evolution. So many stereotypes that we have of deeply racist stereotypes of colonized peoples as not being as advanced or as evolved come from those kinds of debates.
Sadia, there was last year a meeting of the Union for Conservation of Nature, which discussed the possibility of calling for a moratorium on de-extinction. What happened?
So this is the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, which is one of the most important bodies for thinking about the conservation of species worldwide. If you've ever come across updated lists every year of, animals being upgraded from, say, endangered to critically endangered or being officially labelled as extinct, they're the body that is in charge of what's called a red list of endangered species. And they debated whether we should enable genetically modified beings to be used for conservation purposes. So whether, the underlying technologies of something like the direwolf being used in conservation. It was a hugely controversial move, but it's a democratic kind of decision. And ultimately they voted in favor of allowing some form of kind of synthetic biology to be used. How that will be used, we don't know yet, but the possibility is now there, because the moratorium was an attempt to stop that even being considered. So, there are lots of potential options for that happening. The most kind of common examples that you might think of. So if the dodo was brought back or the direwolf would be brought back, is potentially then releasing them into the wild. A passenger pigeon is another example. But I think two of the most interesting potentially are the mammoth, and the thylacine. The mammoth in particular, partly because so many people have such an emotional reaction to it. I think when people think of de-extinct species, it's one of the kind of species that people are most keen to see brought back.
Yes.
And in addition, we already have an area that's being created for the return of the mammoth called Pleistocene Park that is being set up by a scientist called Sergey Zimov, who's basically essentially trying to create space for them in in Siberia so that w when they are brought back, there is a home ready for them to walk into, as it were. The IUCN's decision to allow modified beings into ecosystems makes that much, much more likely for the mammoth to return to Pleistocene Park, or rather, a genetically engineered being that we will call the mammoth that will get returned to Pleistocene Park.
Because you make the point in Vanished that you have to reproduce or bring back the environment for the animal, which is, I suppose, easier for the mammoth because you're talking about sort of a wilderness that survives. But what happens if you bring back the dodo? I mean, is its environment remotely surviving?
I think in some ways you can say but both environments are not possible, but the hope with the mammoth is that it will recreate its own environment. So effectively, one of the kind of arguments that's made for mammoth de-extinction is to claim that it could convert frozen tundra back into grasslands. So it's often promoted as a conservation strategy that will actually re by recreating its own environment and its own ecosystem through existence, through breaking up ice and so on, and these landscapes and converting them into landscapes that are livable for other creatures. It will help not only address climate change, but also recreate a lost ecosystem that can then be populated by lots and lots of other species. Whereas the dodo, I think, is a different story in that, it's a significantly more complicated story because Mauritius's ecosystem has changed so profoundly with the introduction of mammals and so on. And how that might even be attempted, I think, is deeply kind of unsettled and uncertain.
Does it worry you that outfits like Colossal Biosciences, firstly, are raising a huge amount of money, and secondly, that this is going to be a private enterprise approach to bringing back lost species?
I think there are many things to be concerned about with respect to de-extinction, and the money is just one side of it. But it's also a question of democratic control. So many people who oppose de-extinction, for instance, will make the argument that they're very, very concerned about it potentially taking away resources from existing conservation strategies. And de-extinction enthusiasts often respond to that by saying, well, a lot of our money comes from private donations, and so it wouldn't necessarily divert resources. And I think they're quite possibly right. There may well be lots and lots of people who are happy to donate to de-extinction research that might not be all that bothered about conservation and so on. So there is that possibility. But then that raises the question of where is that wealth coming from? How has it been generated? And also, should private wealth be to have such an outsized role in shaping what we think of as alive? So coming back to Celia, for instance, the story I was saying, there are some people who say, argue that Celia never went extinct in the first place because her genome continued existing. And the same argument could be made for genomes existing in frozen arcs and frozen zoos all over the world, because there are now lots and lots of collections of frozen samples of tissue in the hope that one day they might then be used to clone an animal or to do further research and so on. So if that vision and that definition of extinction becomes widely established or used, that then creates a sort of in-between state between being alive, dead, and extinct, where because the IUCN defines extinction as the loss of the last living individual. But if you say that a frozen genome means that that species still exists, you create this new state of existence that has been very variously called latent or evolutionarily torpid.
Yes.
And, I think we need to think very, very carefully about what that means for how we think of life, not just death or extinction, but life and what it means to be alive. And that brings us back to the outsize kind of impact of this wealth in those decisions. And it is far beyond democratic control if it's being done through private companies and private forms of fundraising. And of course, we're living in a time now where we've just literally seen within a matter of days to some extent, the creation of the world's first trillionaire. And, we really, really have to think about what allowing such wealth to accumulate does to power and its concentration and its political impact in our world. And that matters not just because of the money, but also because de-extinction is effectively trying to create particular futures. People often talk about de-extinction as a form of bringing back something, whether it's the mammoth or the direwolf. But really, what's happening is that because new life forms are being created, new futures are being created, and new relationships to life are being created. And I think we need to think extremely carefully about whether wealth should be the deciding factor in that.
Sadia, thank you for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
I've been talking to Sadia Qureshi, who is the Chair of Modern British History at the University of Manchester, has written this wonderful book, Vanished: An Unnatural History of Extinction, and lately an article in Aeon magazine, Reversing Extinction, where her argument is set out very beautifully. And can I say, Sadia, that is the second mention of Cuvier we've had in the last couple of weeks on Late Night Live. We were
Gosh, that
talking.
must be a rarity.
Yes, indeed. We were talking about the establishment of the first public zoo after the French Revolution and
Yeah.
his role in that. Thanks for being with us on Late Night Live.
Thank you so much.